Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. And our first main headline on the front page is Virus Forces Changes at Jails, Courts. Pandemic prompts Dubuque authorities to rethink incarcerations and court proceedings. Dubuque County officials say measures taken to reduce jail overcrowding during the pandemic will likely lead to permanent changes in detaining low-level offenders. Efforts to prevent the highly contagious virus from wreaking havoc inside a densely packed jail has spurred local law enforcement to jail fewer people and criminal justice officials to release more inmates who do not pose a risk to the public. Law enforcement in the county have been advised to issue citations or court summons when possible in lieu of arrest and detention for nonviolent misdemeanor crimes, such as simple drug possession and operating while intoxicated. For someone being held on simple possession of marijuana, what's the sense of that? Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said. When you have low-level offenders being arrested on nonviolent crimes, it doesn't make much sense for the people to be held in the jail for an extended period as they await a bond review, pretrial conferences, or other court proceedings. They're no threat to the community. They just made a bad decision on that particular day and time and ended up in jail. Because they or a family member could not post bail, are homeless, or are intoxicated and cannot be released into the care of a sober, responsible adult, Kennedy said. County Attorney C.J. May III echoed that sentiment. I think we should leave discretion in the hand of the arresting officer as to what needs to be done for the safety of the community and the safety of the arrested person, May said. Those being held in the county jail fall into three categories. Those being held for court, those being held pending transport to prison, and a few serving jail sentences. The more we can move those cases along, the better, May said. Those waiting for court will likely keep a closer eye on how long they've been held in jail and push those along to get them resolved, checking and following up and seeing what the jail population consists of. Some inmates have been released with GPS monitoring. And smaller cash bonds have been waived in favor of unsecured appearance bonds, while prosecutors and defense attorneys have worked with judges to expedite bond review hearings, as many civil proceedings could not be held. Judges are more inclined to release people charged with nonviolent misdemeanors with pretrial supervision on an unsecured appearance bond, where in the past they would have had to post a partial cash bond to get out of jail, May said. Judges, too, are allowing offenders to plead guilty, pay a fine, and be done with their case for certain minor offenses during their initial appearance, May said. As a result of the changes, the Dubuque County jail population fell by almost half since February, to the lowest point since at least 2006. The reduced inmate population has meant jail staff have been able to classify and separate inmates facing trial on violent charges from being housed alongside those detained for less serious infractions. Feeding and housing fewer inmates also means less cost to the taxpayer, Kennedy said. Nothing, however, will change when it comes to individuals arrested for breaking no-contact orders and for domestic assaults, felonies, and serious crimes, he and May stressed. We want to make sure the public is protected from people who have a history of violence, Kennedy said. District Judge Thomas Bitter echoed those comments. For the last few months, bonds have been set and or changed a bit more liberally, Bitter said, but not at the expense of community safety. Moving forward, bonds may continue to be viewed a bit differently following a return to normal, Bitter said. Whether more people will be placed on pretrial supervision or GPS monitoring is difficult to say, he said. Those things are time and labor intensive for the Department of Correctional Services, and their resources can only be stretched so thin. Bitter praised Dubuque County law enforcement and jail staff for a remarkable job of continuing to operate the jail without COVID-19 outbreaks. Many defendants asked to be released because they claimed the jail was a place where they could not socially distance from others. And because of that, the jail was akin to a tinderbox if the virus was introduced, Bitter said. Thankfully, we weren't faced with the dilemma of having to potentially release violent or dangerous people because of an outbreak within the jail. A group of 10 Dubuque County jail inmates have filed a lawsuit in federal court alleging cruel and unusual punishment due to a lack of measures to protect them from the COVID-19 outbreak. Kennedy has flatly denied the allegations. County might freeze some raises. Due to ramifications of the ongoing pandemic, the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors discussed freezing scheduled raises for administrative positions on Monday. In February, supervisors approved a 3% raise for sheriff, a 1.5% raise for other elected officials, and a 0.75% raise for themselves for fiscal year 2021, beginning July 1st. This came after the Dubuque County Compensation Board recommended higher raises for all positions, which the supervisors deemed too high for the second consecutive year. But the following month, the nation was hit by the COVID-19 pandemic wave. Its impacts to the economy and the resulting effects on county government revenues are yet to be fully realized, but are expected to be significant. Therefore, County Human Resources Director Don Sherman thought it best to check in. All of that was decided prior to COVID and experiencing the loss of revenues, she said. We've had discussions in the bargaining unit, but if there are going to be changes in this, they'll need to be made in open session. Supervisor Jay Wickham pointed out changes to society and the economy caused by the pandemic, including significant unemployment as reasons to reconsider. I think it's wise for the board to look at our existing wage levels and existing increases to those wage levels and see if there are adjustments that need to be made, he said. Wickham therefore proposed a freeze of elected officials and non-bargaining county employees' salaries at fiscal year 2020 levels, with some exceptions. That met with swift backlash from some of those whom the change would impact. County Auditor Denise Dolan, who will retire at the end of her term in January 2021, pointed to the supervisor's ready appropriation of almost $2.4 million and the county spending of $1.4 million of that in an attempt to address the pandemic as proof that the county need not cut salary increases. There is no holding back and throwing money by the Board of Supervisors towards expenses for COVID, she said. Dolan reported receiving many comments from the public about that appropriation and spending. Subsequently, we now see a proposal to cut the wages to management personnel in the county, she said. I just think that's a little sad and a little two-faced. Sheriff Joe Kennedy argued on behalf of his staff, deputy sheriff, captains, and sergeants, whose salaries were tied to his and would therefore also be affected. They have been here every day that they've been scheduled, unlike many county employees who are being paid to sit at home, he said. We've not been offered hazard pay, which even private sector workers, manufacturing workers in this county have been offered. Sunnycrest Manor was offered double time for overtime. My employees were not offered the same. Kennedy said his officers are already facing extra stress due to nationwide protests against the killing of unarmed Black Americans by police. Our line of work, in case anybody hasn't noticed, we're under a lot of fire lately, he said. It's hard enough for us to find and retain people. Now you want to take away their pay and benefits. Wickham explained that the exceptions he had mentioned were meant to include the sheriff's office in Sunnycrest Manor. County Veterans Affairs Executive Director Randy Renison also lambasted the proposal. Supervisor Dave Baker also argued against the wage freeze, characterizing it as going after county employees. I believe we should honor our commitments and go forward, he said. Then, if belt tightening is needed, we look at that next year and make whatever decisions we have to make. Supervisor Ann McDonough argued that the proposal warranted consideration, particularly due to the Iowa legislature not budgeting any additional aid to local governments during its return to session last week. That we're thinking about this is a reflection of the time we're in, she said, but everyone should know that the state of Iowa did us no favors over the last 7 days. Supervisors did not act on the proposal Monday, but Wickham said it was not dead. If you ask anyone in the private sector how many employees in the private sector are receiving the types of wages we're looking at, you won't find them, he said. To go through our fund balances as if nothing has happened, I don't think that is wise as a leader. Beds for kids, not just a dream. During church one morning, Keith Kramer glanced down at a bulletin that listed church updates. As he continued to skim the flyer, he noticed a sentence or two about an organization he had never heard of before. It had a brief description that mentioned providing kids with beds. After reading more in a local newspaper and doing some research, Kramer found a Jones County chapter of the national organization Sleep and Heavenly Peace, and he knew he needed to talk to someone about starting it in his area. I was just looking for something different, said Kramer, who also serves on the board of the Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque. You see a food bank, and that is an ongoing deal. But a bed can also make a difference for their lifetime. I thought we could do the project and make a difference in Delaware County. After meeting with Heather Weirs, the chapter president in Jones County, Kramer was hooked. He saw the need Jones County had among youth lacking beds and realized it was something overlooked in Delaware County as well. I think it's needed to get these kids off the floor, or lots of times they are sharing beds, or sometimes it's a couch, Kramer said. They aren't sleeping right. I think it boosts their confidence level when they start realizing they've got their own bed. they are always going to sleep better. Early this year, Kramer flew out to Idaho, where Sleep in Heavenly Peace is based, along with Lynn Chestnut, who also was interested in helping start a chapter in Delaware County. It's a great organization that is going to definitely benefit the kids of our local county, Chestnut said. It's a definite eye-opener. I didn't think there was a need in our area, but there definitely is. In order to get equipment and supplies needed to make the beds, Kramer reached out to local businesses and individuals for donations. I just continue to spread the word, Kramer said. I've got a lot of good friends who have always supported my projects, and I talked to some church groups who also made homemade quilts for the beds. So far, the Sleep in Heavenly Peace organization has only delivered one bed to a child in Delaware County, but it has supplies and equipment to make and donate many more. We did one build just prior to the shutdown, and we completed 18 beds. We did a team build where we brought in a group of people and built a bunch of beds in a few hours. Now that the state is reopening, volunteers with Sleep in Heavenly Peace are ready to begin delivering beds and hope to start a group build with local churches, businesses, and other Delaware County organizations, Chestnut said. In Jones County, Weir said she had no idea how needed beds were until the Jones County Partnership for Protecting Children received a $1,500 grant to provide area children with beds in 2018. The grant money was gone in a month, said Weirs, a coordinator with the Jones County PPC. I started researching and learned about Sleep in Heavenly Peace in Cedar Rapids. Weirs says it had been less than a year since she started the chapter in Jones County, and already 100 beds have been donated to families in the county. I would say we have hit every age range of recipients, Weirs said. It is just something you never think about, and just to help that child have their own bed is a big deal. Although the excitement surrounding the Delaware County chapter ended as soon as it began because of the pandemic, Chestnut said they are ready to bring the momentum back. You can do something that is so beneficial for kids in your neighborhood, he said. There are kids you don't even realize people in your own backyard have. There are needs you don't even realize people in your own backyard have. It's really great to see the joy in kids' faces when they get a bed to sleep in. And now looking at the almanac, there's 197 days left in the year, as today is the 169th day of 2020. On this date, in 1579, Sir Francis Drake arrived in present-day Northern California, naming it New Albion and claiming English sovereignty. In 1775, the Revolutionary War Battle of Bunker Hill resulted in a costly victory for the British, who suffered heavy losses. In 1930, President Herbert Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which boosted U.S. tariffs to historically high levels, prompting foreign retaliation. In 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court in Abington, Pennsylvania School District versus Shemp struck down 8-1 rules requiring the recitation of the Lord's Prayer or reading of biblical verses in public schools. In 1967, China successfully tested its first thermonuclear hydrogen bomb. And now in some people news, Kimmel to host Emmy's first major awards show of the pandemic. This comes from Los Angeles. Jimmy Kimmel will host the first major Hollywood awards ceremony of the coronavirus pandemic, but just how the Emmys will be held remains cloudy. Kimmel, who is also producing the September 20th ceremony on ABC, honoring TV's best, acknowledged that in Tuesday's announcement. I don't know where we'll do this or how we'll do this or even why we are doing this, but we are doing it, and I am hosting it, the ABC Late Night host said in a statement. The network said details on the show's production will be announced soon. Choosing Kimmel to MC the ceremony reverses course from last year's no-host Emmys. The entertainment industry is just beginning to restart production following a months-long shutdown aimed at curtailing the spread of COVID-19. Orchestrating an awards ceremony during the ongoing pandemic with its crowd of presenters, nominees, and guests is a daunting prospect, virtually or otherwise. Nominations for the 72nd Primetime Emmys will be announced by the TV Academy on July 28th. And now into Dubuque and Tri-State news. Opening weeks for Dubuque Casino, fantastic. A Dubuque casino has seen a surge in visitors since reopening at the beginning of the month, officials said. Q Casino and Hotel CEO Jesus Avalez said Tuesday that financials for the first 2 weeks of operation following an extended closure during the COVID-19 pandemic were fantastic. He spoke at a meeting of the Dubuque Racing Association Board of Directors. It's been fantastic, Avalez said. It was probably more than I expected. Q Casino officials give a brief update on the facility's reopening and revenues so far this year during the DRA board meeting. The DRA is the nonprofit license holder for Dubuque's two casinos. Q Casino General Manager Brian Rakestraw told board members that staff reopened slots and the Q Sports Bar on June 1st and the table games last Friday with social distancing measures in place. Since reopening, the casino has seen a large increase in visits from returning customers and new customers from Illinois and Wisconsin. We are benefiting from the casinos in Illinois still being closed, and the casinos in Wisconsin are now just starting to open back up, Rakestraw said. He noted, however, that casinos in other states saw spikes in demand after reopening that dropped off after a few weeks. That means numbers at Q Casino could also level or drop off. We hope it doesn't happen, but we need to be prepared for that, he said. Both Q Casino and Diamond Joe Casino in Dubuque were closed for part of March and for April and May due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Thus, neither facility generated gaming revenue during the month of May, according to the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. The two casinos brought in a total of $10.8 million in adjusted gross revenue from gaming during May 2019. Bill Eichhorn, chief financial officer for Q Casino, said gaming revenue so far this year sits at $10.4 million through the end of May, a 50.4% drop over the same period last year. Likewise, Diamond Joe saw adjusted gross revenue for gaming of about $14.2 million from January through May, according to the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. That is about half of what the casino brought in over the same period last year. Officials from Diamond Joe did not respond to requests for comment. Following Tuesday's meeting, Avalez confirmed that a project to construct a new hotel at Q Casino is on hold until further notice, given uncertainties caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Not having an income source and making sure that other issues are taken care of, like our employees, our Hilton Garden Inn hotel employees as well, we thought it would be more prudent to put that on hold until things are normalized, and then we can dust it off the shelf and take a look at it again, Avalez said. Board members did not discuss the DRA's annual grant program during their meeting. Board members voted earlier this year to postpone awarding the grants. Avalez said after the meeting that the DRA still would like to disperse grants to local nonprofits this year, but noted the fluidity of situations caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Dubuque's only female mayor remembered for her service. In the days before Sister Carolyn Farrell, BVM, died, she told her longtime friend, Sister Terry Hadro, "It's all about service. If there was a job to do, Carolyn was the one you looked to get it started," said Hadro, president of the Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She knew how to launch things. Farrell, a member of the BVM Sisters since 1953, died Sunday at age 85. She served the Dubuque community and beyond in a number of roles over the years, notably as Dubuque's first female city council member from 1978 to 1981 and the city's only female mayor in 1980. She also held an administrative role at Clark College and served as St. Patrick's School principal from 1969 to 1974. She was the kind of person where, once she had a conversation with you, you went into her Rolodex, and she would find something for you to do on one of the many projects she had going on, Hadro said. If you ever called a person a spark plug, Carolyn was a spark plug. In addition to a fondness for cooking, reading, and playing bridge, Farrell was passionate about people, and women in particular, Hadro said. Farrell was quoted in several Telegraph Herald articles about her role as the first female city council member and the attention that historic title brought. If you come on too strong on that whole woman's question, you'll turn people off, and then you're ineffectual, Farrell said in a January 2, 1981, Telegraph Herald article. You can't just do it. And in Dubuque, you have to work with men. You have to be part of the old boys gang to survive because there aren't any women anyplace else. Farrell was chosen as Dubuque's mayor in 1980 at a time when the city council selected a mayor from among the council members instead of holding an election for the role. Her position as mayor garnered national attention because of the rarity of a religious sister serving in elected office. A statement from the Vatican later clarified that holding such a position was prohibited. I could never have run for re-election, Farrell said years later. Former Dubuque Mayor Walter Pregler said he was voted off the council the year Farrell was elected mayor by her peers, so he didn't directly work with her. However, Farrell was quick to recruit him to be the first chairman of the Community Advisory Development Commission. Pregler said she gave back to her community and was a talented individual. There were an awful lot of eyebrows raised when she ran, but I congratulate her for being so straightforward, Pregler said. Mayor Roy Buell said Farrell is the only female mayor Dubuque has seen to date, a fact he hopes changes one day. She was a trailblazer in many respects, Bull said. She was well-respected in the community and always looking out for the lesser among us. After her retirement from the education field, Farrell became the director of the BVM Sisters Roberta Kuhn Center, which provides educational opportunities to those age 55 and older on a variety of topics. Through her multitude of projects and commitments, most recently with the Dubuque Coalition for Nonviolence, Farrell seemed tireless in her effort to support causes combating injustice and to reach out as a friend to those who needed one, Hadro said. A full obituary for Farrell will run in Sunday's Telegraph Herald. 6 new COVID-19 cases in Grant County. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Tuesday's developments included Dubuque County recorded 3 more cases of COVID-19 from 5 p.m. Monday to 5 p.m. Tuesday. The county's total stood at 390 cases at the latter time. There were no additional Dubuque County deaths, and the death toll remains at 22. Clayton, Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties all had no additional cases. Totals in those counties are 35, 27, 14, and 41, respectively. None of the area counties had additional deaths. Clayton County has had 3 deaths, Delaware County 1, while Jones and Jackson have had none. The number of positive cases at Dubuque Specialty Care remained at 51 between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday, with the number of recovered patients also the same at 21. It is one of 2 long-term care outbreaks in the Iowa portion of the Telegraph Herald coverage area. As of Tuesday night, Edgewood Convalescent Home still had 10 cases, with 2 recovered. Statewide, 97 new cases were recorded between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday. The total as of the latter time was 24,179. 11 additional related deaths were reported during that time span. There have been 669 so far. Grant County, Wisconsin reported 6 additional cases between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday, bringing the county's total to 113. Iowa County, Wisconsin reported 1 additional case in the same time span, bringing its total to 18. Crawford and Lafayette counties each reported no additional cases, remaining at 27 and 43 respectively. The Crawford County Public Health Department posted a press release on social media regarding the community COVID-19 testing event held on June 12th in Prairie du Chien. Officials called it successful, noting that 276 individuals were tested, a combination of symptomatic and asymptomatic people approved. 1 positive case resulted from the community test. The individual who tested positive did not have contact with a confirmed case and had not traveled outside the area, therefore is considered community spread. The press release states confirmed cases were reported Tuesday. In Wisconsin, 266 new confirmed cases were reported Tuesday, pushing the state total to 23,198. 9 additional related deaths were added to the state's official count, now at 703. In Illinois, 623 new cases and 72 additional related deaths were reported Tuesday. That pushed the state's totals to 133,639 cases and 6,398 deaths. No additional cases or deaths have been reported in Joe Davies County. Authorities on Monday recovered a body of a teen in the Mississippi River in Crawford County. Nathan M. Featherson, age 18, of Waterloo, Iowa, is presumed to have drowned, according to the county sheriff's department on Tuesday. The department reported that it was notified at about 3:15 a.m. Sunday that a person was missing in the Mississippi River near Gordon's Bay boat landing in Eastman. A press release states that authorities believe he was trying to swim to a nearby island where a group of people was camping when he went under and could not be located. Emergency agencies combed the area Sunday and Monday before the teen's body was found north of Prairie du Chien on Monday afternoon. The authorities announced that development Tuesday. The case remains under investigation. Police, no injuries in wreck that snarled traffic in Key West area. Police said no injuries were reported in a crash that snarled traffic on the south edge of Dubuque on Tuesday. A vertical lift fell off of a trailer being hauled by a dump truck at about 4:45 p.m., according to Lieutenant Ted McClyman. That occurred as the dump truck turned from Twin Valley Drive onto the northbound lane of U.S. 5261-151 in the Key West area. The crash closed the northbound lanes of the highway for a little less than 1 hour as crews worked at the scene to clean up the wreck. McClyman said the name of the driver and other details were not available Tuesday night. The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department reported, and this is some of the from the police blotter, Michael L. Lott, age 37, of 2340 Central Avenue, number 2, was arrested at 7:09 p.m. Monday at the Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on charges of tampering with a witness, a juror, and violation of a domestic abuse protective order. Rio Cameron, age 26, of 419 Loris Boulevard, number 2, was arrested at 5:22 p.m. Monday at 1402 Lincoln Avenue on a charge of domestic assault. Court documents state that Cameron assaulted Amy L. Kirkpatrick, age 43, of 1402 Lincoln Avenue. Catherine M. Triervalier, and I probably pronounced that wrong, Triervalier, age 56, of 580 Sapphire Circle, reported $500 worth of damage to a vehicle at her residence between 4 and 8:50 p.m. on Saturday. Hannah A. Cole, age 18, of 2272 Central Avenue, reported fraud of $500 at about 6:30 p.m. Saturday. Norman T. Mayberry, age 56, of 3465 Pennsylvania Avenue, number 6, reported the theft of a bicycle valued at $500 from Quickstar at 2035 John F. Kennedy Road between 1201 and 6 a.m. Saturday. And Brendan M. Terrence, age 20, of 1820 Loris Boulevard, reported the theft of $200 and $500 worth of items from his residence between 3 a.m. Tuesday and 1:40 p.m. Wednesday. Now going into our opinion section here, Reynolds should sign order on felon voting rights. Yet another session of the Iowa legislature has closed without movement on automatically restoring the voting rights of felons after they have completed their sentences, despite the fact that Governor Kim Reynolds opened the session calling for the issue to have top priority. It's time for Reynolds to take matters into her own hands and sign an executive order to get it done. Reynolds confirmed Tuesday that she plans to sign such an order before the November general election, and she should do so. Last week, the Iowa House of Representatives had some movement on the issue, passing a measure, but not before adding a clause requiring all restitution be repaid before voting rights would be restored. That amendment proved controversial, with Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, Democrat of Dubuque, calling it another knee on the neck of a black man. Proponents suggest that paying restitution is, in fact, part of sentencing, and a sentence is not technically concluded until it is paid in full. But the fact of the matter is restitution in some cases extends for years and even a lifetime, well beyond the time served. An alternative could be to allow voting rights to be restored as long as the convicted felon is meeting the requirements and making restitution payments. But keeping tabs on that sounds like a tall order for a process that is already riddled with bureaucratic hoops that people convicted of a felony must jump through to be able to vote once they have served out their sentences and paid court fines. When Reynolds announced in her 2019 condition of the state speech that she would automatically make restoring felon voting rights a priority, Iowa was one of only two states that didn't already have this process in place. Today is the only state. It hasn't always been that way. In 2005, then-Governor Tom Vilsack issued an executive order automatically restoring felons' voting rights once they left state supervision. His successor, Chet Culver, continued that policy during his four-year term. When Terry Branstad returned to the governor's office in 2011, he switched to his previous practice of a lifetime ban on voting unless the privilege is specifically restored by the governor. The application process is complicated. Many convicts don't go through the hassle. Reynolds is right. It's time to change the rule. Ideally, it would be specifically mandated by law passed by the legislature rather than the whim of governors issuing executive orders. The back and forth creates confusion and inconsistency. But over the weekend, Iowa Senate Republicans, for the second year in a row, killed a proposed constitutional amendment, with some suggesting they did so because they anticipated an executive order to be forthcoming. While the consistency of a constitutional amendment would be preferable, Reynolds' executive order remains the only option at this point. In a year in which lawmakers unanimously supported a historic police reform bill, and Reynolds signed it into law outside amid chants of Black Lives Matter, out on the steps of the Capitol, failure to act on felony voting rights would be to miss a key change supported by the movement as well as the governor. It's time for Reynolds to sign the executive order automatically restoring felon voting rights once their sentences have been served and fines paid. The time has come. And this is an editorial. It say note, editorials reflect the consensus of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for June 17th, Wednesday, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. James A., known as Jim Baker, age 92 of Asbury, Iowa, died Monday, June 15, 2020, at his home. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 18th, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service at 3860 Asbury Road. Please respect our current social distancing requirements. If you're not feeling well or unable to attend, we encourage you to visit www.hskfhcares.com to send our virtual hug to Jim's family. The massive Christian burial for Jim will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, June 19th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Key West, with Reverend Father Rodney Allers as the celebrant. Burial will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post No. 6. The first service will be live streamed on Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at www.hskfhcares.com. James was born March 7, 1928 in Dubuque, the son of Harry A. and Margaret E. Shadle Baker. He received his education at Nativity and Holy Trinity Catholic Schools and Dubuque Senior High School. He joined the U.S. Navy in 1945 and was honorably discharged in 1947. He served aboard the USS Paul G. Baker, the DE-642. His tour of duty was in Asia, serving time in China and Japan. While he was in the U.S. Naval Hospital in San Diego, he attended school to receive his GED. After returning to Dubuque, he worked at John Deere for 34 years, retiring in 1982. He worked 10 years as a machine operator and setup man, and 24 years as a supervisor. On April 23, 1949, he married Nyra Potter in St. Mary's Church. They had 7 children, Edward Baker, Robert Baker, Gail Winter, Jack Baker, Peggy Hopman, Lisa Hopman, James R. Baker, and 30 grandchildren and 50 great-grandchildren. Nyra went to heaven on May 21, 1993. On February 18, 1995, he married Katie Kruger. Katie had 3 children, Dan Grutz, who is deceased, Gina Cesaretti, and Julie Rima. After Katie died, he lived alone and life wasn't good. With the help of Gail, they found a senior apartment on Starlight at the Woodland. He met the manager, who was Shirley. One day after a windstorm, Shirley asked if he would fix her flagpole, which he did. When he was leaving, she asked, "How much do I owe you?" Which he responded, "A kiss would do." You all know the rest of the story. On July 10, 2010, they moved to the Village Co-op in Asbury. On April 8, 2011, they eloped and got married, and Jim was happy to have been befriended by her family, Luann Bregman, and friends Al Cox, Terry Strube, Vicki Weber, Peter Strube, Janet Shepherd, and all her grandchildren. Jim was very thankful for having 3 wonderful women in his life. He is also survived by his brother Jerry Baker, his sister Elaine Thurston, and sister-in-law Rita Baker. Jim did volunteer work for St. Vincent de Paul, St. Mary's Parish, and served as a volunteer pallbearer for St. Vincent de Paul. He also did work for Washington Tool Library and St. Vincent Food Bank. He was a lifetime member of the DAV and belonged to the John Deere Retiree and Supervisor Club. He was also a loyal fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes and the Green Bay Packers. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established. If family or friends would like to send a memorial contribution, please mail them to Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home, Attention Jim Baker Family, at 3860 Asbury Road in Dubuque, Iowa, 52002, and we will gladly forward them to the family. The family thanks Hospice of Dubuque, his caregivers Penny and Molly, and especially our sister Vicki Weber for all she has done. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of the arrangements. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences sent to the family by visiting Jim's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Carol M. Betchen, maiden name Reval, age 57 of Dubuque, passed away at her home after a long 7.5-year battle with cancer, surrounded by her loving husband and son. To celebrate Carol's life, private family services will be held with Reverend Stephen J. Rozonke officiating. Entombment will be in the mausoleum at the Mount Calvary Cemetery. Bear Funeral Home at 1491 Main Street is in charge of arrangements. Carol was born on October 3, 1962 in Dubuque, Iowa, daughter of Richard and Evelyn Reval. Carol attended school at St. Anthony's Grade School and went on to graduate from Dubuque Senior High School, class of 1981. Carol met Tom Betchen and they moved to Casper, Wyoming, where they had a son, Tom Jr., who was her pride and joy. She was employed by M.T. Bell and Lerner's Clothing Stores. After living in Wyoming for 8 years, they returned to Dubuque, and Carol worked in retail and optical. For the last 20 years, she managed the store and was a certified optician for a local optical center. Customer service and meeting with patients brought her great enjoyment, and many of them became her friends. In her free time, Carol enjoyed spending time with family and friends, shopping, working out, and water walking each summer. She also had a great love of animals, especially dogs, and Dodger was by far her favorite. Those left to cherish Carol's memory include her loving husband, Tom Betchen Sr. in Dubuque, her son, Tom Betchen Jr. of Janesville, Wisconsin, her grandson and the joy of her life, Nolan Betchen, her mother, Evelyn Rival in Dubuque, her sister, Jean Merritt in Dubuque, her in-laws, Ray Betchen of Dubuque, Pam Mays of Casper, Wyoming, Rayanne Betchen of Denver, Colorado, and Carla Lake of Dubuque, Iowa, and numerous aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, and too many friends to mention. Carol was preceded in death by her father, Richard Rival, a brother-in-law, Mark Redmond, and a sister-in-law, Laura Jack Naderman. Carol would like to thank Dr. Ann Stroh and the staff of the Hall Perrine Cancer Center in Cedar Rapids for the support and the excellent care that she received, and Hospice of Dubuque for all her wonderful care. In lieu of flowers, memorials will be accepted by the family and can be mailed to Bear Funeral Home at 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa 52001, attention Carol Betchen, family, and will be distributed among the Dubuque Humane Society, Hall Perrine Cancer Center, and the Ronald McDonald House of Madison. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Sister Dorothy Feehan, BVM, age 93, of 1130 Carmel Drive, Dubuque, Iowa, died Sunday, June 14th at Caritas Center. Sharing of memories via Zoom will be from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. on Friday, June 19th. The virtual visitation will be from 10:30 to 10:45 a.m., followed immediately by the Mass of Christian Burial. Burial is in the Mount Carmel Cemetery. Sister Dorothy was an education department instructor at Clark University in Dubuque, Iowa. She was an elementary teacher in Fort Dodge and Sioux City, Iowa, Chicago, and in Missoula, Montana, where she also served as principal and later as spiritual director. After serving as a regional representative for the BVM congregation, she was a pastoral minister in Longmont and Arvada, Colorado, where she also ministered as religious education director. She was a ministry training services staff member in Littleton, Colorado. She was born on February 15, 1927, in Oak Park, Illinois, to James and Irene Feehan. She entered the BVM congregation on February 2, 1945, from Ascension Parish, Oak Park, Illinois. She professed first vows on August 15, 1947, and final vows on August 15, 1952. She was preceded in death by her parents and sisters, Margaret Mary Graver, Cecilia O'Meara, and Irene Allen. She is survived by nieces and the Sisters of Charity BVM, whom she shared life for 74 years. Memorials may be given to Sisters of Charity BVM Support Fund at 1100 Carmel Drive, Dubuque, Iowa 52003, or online at https://www.bvmsisters.org/support_donate.cfm. Mary Lou Thomas, age 80, of Dyersville, passed away peacefully Monday, June 15, 2020, at her home surrounded by her family. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 19th at Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest in Dyersville. Visitation will continue Saturday, June 20th from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. at Kramer Funeral Home prior to funeral services. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 20th, 2020, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. Mary Lou was born November 28, 1939, in Dyersville, the daughter of Laverne and Bernice Lansing. She married David Rettinger and had five children together, but later divorced. She married Bill Thomas in 1978, and he preceded her in death in 2013. Mary Lou worked as a CNA for Mercy Medical Center in Dyersville for 40 years. She enjoyed playing the accordion, golfing, crocheting, and going to the casino. Survivors include her children, Dan Rettinger, Mike Rettinger, both of Dyersville, Mark Rettinger of Verona, Wisconsin, and Jay Rettinger of Dyersville, a son-in-law, Bob Tiegler of Dyersville, the father of her children, Dave Rettinger of Dyersville, six grandchildren and nine great-grandchildren, siblings Don Lansing, Betty Bockenstedt, both of Dyersville, and Carol Davis of Farley. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, Bill Thomas, one daughter, Sandy Tiegler, and siblings Richard and Darlene Lansing in infancy. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.kramerfuneral.com. George W. Flanagan, age 72, of Leisure Lake, formerly of Dubuque, died June 16, 2020, at home, surrounded by family. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 18th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory at 2595 Rockdale Road. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, June 19th, at the funeral home. Complete arrangements are pending. James, or Jim, W. Heim, age 59, of Rockford, Illinois, passed away Tuesday, June 9th, 2020. He was born November 17, 1960, in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Irma and Kenneth Heim. Services were held Sunday, June 14th, at Cathedral of St. Peter, Rockford, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family and may be mailed to Fitzgerald for the family in honor of James. Share online condolences at www.fitzgeraldfh.com. Harlan Edward Bruner, age 82, of Savannah, passed away Sunday, June 14th, at Allure Nursing Home in Mount Carroll, Illinois. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, June 19th, at the Mount Carroll Church of God in Mount Carroll, Illinois. A visitation will take place from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 18th, at the church. Robert William Meyer, age 75, of Prairie du Chien, formerly of St. Olaf, Iowa, died Monday, June 15th, at his home. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, June 18th, at Leonard Grauf Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona, Iowa. Graveside service will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 19th, at Rossville Cemetery in Rossville, Iowa. Lee Allen, known as Lee Hafer, passed away Saturday, June 13th, at Beloit Memorial Hospital. A memorial service will be held Saturday, June 27th, at 11 a.m. at Law Jones Funeral Home in Mount Carroll, Illinois. Visitation will take place from 10 to 11 a.m. with a luncheon to follow the service. Sarah Pauline Enyart, age 85, of Postville, Iowa, died Monday, June 15th, at Good Samaritan Society in Postville, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 19th, at Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Monona, Iowa. There will be a private family funeral and graveside service. And now moving back into news articles, let's see, we'll go to our tri-state section. Lancaster Pool begins phased opening Saturday. After more than 2.5 years of planning, fundraising, and construction, Lancaster's new municipal swimming pool will begin a phased opening on Saturday, June 20th. But a raft shaped like a blue porpoise will not be among the amenities immediately available to patrons. The floaty represents a touch point that could facilitate the spread of COVID-19. A scenario city staff are taking pains to avoid as they open up the new $3.2 million city facility. To address COVID-19, we are trying to incorporate safe distancing, said pool manager Sarah Pross. We wanted to open up soft. The pool's opening was approved unanimously by council members Monday. During the first week of operations, the pool will be available only for lap swimming. Common council members left it to city staff to determine the next stage during the week beginning Sunday, June 28th. Which will add open swimming, water aerobics, and possibly swimming lessons to the mix. At most, 30 patrons will be permitted at the pool. That limit applies to open swim, which will occur in 75-minute sessions. The low numbers, well below the pool's capacity, reflects a lack of information. Staffers do not know how to best allocate resources to ensure patron safety until they know where crowds will congregate, Pross said. During lap swim, 3 to 7 swimmers will be permitted to use the pool, depending on the day of the week. Sessions will occur for 45 minutes. 15 minutes are allocated for sanitizing high-touch areas between each session. Patrons are expected to remain 6 feet away from other parties not within their group. The diving boards and water slide will remain open, provided that patrons respect social distancing rules. The pool bathhouse will be closed, so patrons are expected to be ready to swim upon arrival. Deck chairs also will be unavailable, so customers wanting a place to sit must bring their own. Concessions, likewise, will not be available. Patrons are encouraged to reserve their admission spots online in advance of arrival. During the first week of operation, pool hours for lap swimming will be from 6 to 8 a.m. Monday through Friday, 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 8 p.m. Sunday. There is no evidence that COVID-19 can spread to people through the water used in properly maintained pools, hot tubs, or water playgrounds, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, The Grant County Health Department and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services have discouraged municipalities from opening public recreation facilities and holding youth sports programs until the state sees a sustained downward trend in new diagnoses. That is the trend in Grant County, according to Health Director Jeff Kindray. As of Tuesday morning, Grant County had confirmed 107 positive cases since testing began in the spring. "I think it's reasonable to consider doing more things and allowing more people to get together," he said, expressing a preference for gatherings of 10 or less. "We've not seen huge increases in cases, but really, one or two events could change that." While Councilmember Bob Schmidt said the pool's capacity should be increased at a faster rate, Council President Shane Labuda said he hopes city staffers do not feel pressured by the public to rush through the opening process. "Let's continue to go slow," he said. New fishing pond coming to Dubuque County. A construction project in Dubuque County is bubbling up new fishing opportunities. The Dubuque County Conservation Board is building a public fishing pond at the Miller-McGrath Wildlife Area between Epworth and Graff, Iowa, with the help of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Manchester Fish Hatchery. Construction of the pond began June 8th and should be complete within the next 2 weeks, according to Brian Preston, Executive Director of Dubuque County Conservation Board. "Exactly when the pond will be ready for anglers depends on how long it takes for the pool to fill naturally after construction is complete. We're always looking to provide more access to public fishing," he said. "It'll be a small pond, but it should work well." The pond will be about 1.5 acres in area when finished. Preston said fish such as bluegill will be stocked in the lake in September, and largemouth bass and catfish will be added in the spring. Much of the funding for the project comes from a DNR Fish Habitat Program grant. Daniel Kirby, an Iowa DNR Fisheries Management biologist, said the program gives about $500,000 annually for county fish habitats. "The grant is covering 90% of the Dubuque County pond's costs," Preston said. "The Conservation Board will only have to spend $3,000 on the $30,000 project." Dubuque County Conservation Board interns also will be installing fish habitats to foster the fish population, Preston added. "In the next 2 or 3 years, the fishing opportunities should be abundant," he said. "It will be conducive for taking kids fishing," he said. "There's no current, and you can keep them near you." Kirby said the DNR will ensure the pond is easy to access once it's complete, and officials are looking at shorelines, parking lots, and signage. The DNR will also help stock fish. "Without these ponds, fish don't have the right water depth or aquatic habitat to survive," Kirby said. "The DNR is always looking to implement new fishing areas in northeast Iowa," Kirby said, "though the geology of the region can make building ponds difficult. The opportunity to construct the new pond at the Miller-McGrath Wildlife Area was a good opportunity to serve area communities' fishing interests," he said. "When you ask people where they want to fish, you have those people who love the Mississippi River, but most still want to fish in lakes or ponds," Kirby said. Cascade Library to reopen today with restrictions. Officials announced plans to open Cascade Public Library today with restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic. The library will limit the number of people allowed in the facility at one time, and all in-person programs are suspended, according to the announcement. Social distancing will be required, and patrons are asked to stay in the library only for the time needed to select items. Computer use will be limited and by appointment only. Staff will wear masks, and officials strongly recommend that the public wear masks and use hand sanitizer upon entering the library, the announcement stated. The bathrooms will be closed. Patrons refusing to follow safety procedures will be asked to leave the facility, and their library privileges will be suspended. Library hours will be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday. Bagley's Thunder in the Valley event canceled. The Bagley Volunteer Fire Department has canceled its annual Thunder in the Valley event due to concerns related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Organizers stated that the Independence Day celebration will return on July 3, 2021. This year's event had been slated for July 4th. Drug offers hope amid spikes in coronavirus infections. As nations grapple with new outbreaks and a spiking death tolls from the coronavirus, a commonly available drug appeared Tuesday to offer up hope that the most seriously ill could have a better chance of survival. The pandemic has forced countries to impose lockdowns and tough restrictions on daily life and travel, but infections have surged as they ease those rules and reopen their economies. With no vaccine available and much still unknown about the virus, researchers in England announced the first drug shown to save lives. The drug, called dexamethasone, reduced deaths by 35% in patients who needed treatment with breathing machines and by 20% in those only needing supplemental oxygen, researchers in England said. It did not appear to help less ill patients. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the drug was the biggest breakthrough yet in treating the coronavirus, and top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci called it a significant improvement in the available therapeutic options that we have. Britain is making dexamethasone available to patients on the country's National Health Service. The UK Department of Health said the drug had been approved to treat all hospitalized COVID-19 patients requiring oxygen, effective immediately. It said the UK had stockpiled enough to treat 200,000 patients. It's on almost every pharmacy shelf in every hospital, and it's available throughout the world, and it's very cheap, said Peter Horby of Oxford University, one of the leaders of the trial that randomly assigned 2,104 patients to get the drug and compared them with 4,321 patients getting only usual care. Since the virus first emerged in China late last year and spread around the globe, there have been more than 8 million confirmed cases and more than 435,000 deaths. The U.S. death toll has reached 116,526, according to Johns Hopkins University. That surpasses the number of Americans who died in World War I, when 116,516 were killed, although both death tolls are far from precise. The United States has more confirmed cases and deaths from COVID-19 than any country in the world. For most people, the virus causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death. The vast majority of people recover, but the more difficult cases last for weeks and sometimes take a bad turn even after symptoms seem to ease. Countries that appeared to have largely contained the virus are seeing new outbreaks. In China, authorities on Tuesday locked down a third neighborhood in Beijing to contain an outbreak that has infected more than 100 people. Most of the cases have been linked to the capital's Xinfadi wholesale food market, and people lined up for massive testing of anyone who had visited it in the past 2 weeks or come in contact with them. About 9,000 workers at the market were tested already. Russia-linked disinformation operations still active as of this year. A Kremlin-linked social media disinformation operation that sought to interfere with the 2016 U.S. election has continued its work to divide and discredit Western democracies, a new report finds, but its effectiveness has been limited by its own cautious tactics. Dubbed secondary infection by researchers, the network was part of Russia's bid to use social media to polarize Americans ahead of the 2016 elections. It's been linked to similar effects in Ukraine, France, Britain, and elsewhere. Since 2014, it has posted thousands of times on more than 300 internet platforms. Content from secondary infection includes posts degrading Muslims and immigrants, accusing Hillary Clinton of murder, and calling German Chancellor Angela Merkel an alcoholic. Some posts have used forged documents or bogus commentary, such as a fake tweet supposedly sent from U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, accusing Britain of spying on President Donald Trump. Graphica, a New York City firm that analyzes social media, published a report Tuesday that traces the network's operations. Compared with other Russian disinformation networks operated by Russian military intelligence or the country's internet research agency, Secondary Infection worked hard to cover its tracks, even if that hindered its work, the report found. They are putting a lot of emphasis on staying hidden rather than quick virality, said Ben Nimmo, Graphica director of investigations and one of the report's lead authors. Many of Secondary Infection's posts came from burner accounts discarded after a single use, before they have time to grow an audience. While that made it harder for analysts to track the work, it also prevented the operation from building accounts with the kind of large, legitimate audiences that are needed to weaponize disinformation. Almost none of those efforts achieved measurable impact, Graphica's report concluded. Another enduring mystery around the operation is what the operators thought they were doing and why they kept on doing it across 6 years of activity when their stories so often died unnoticed. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.